I'm Philip. This is my third presentation, actually fourth if we count the night light trapping last night. It's my second time of doing this at Holden. I was here in 2007, and in May, if you want a river runs through it, you can walk straight through, but we're in the creekside
river.
Go right ahead.
Sorry.
No, that's quite okay. So they asked me to come back, and I am doing a somewhat compressed session because I've got to be out of here on Thursday, unfortunately. I have been passionate about insects since I was born. I happen to be born in Papua New Guinea, which has the most abundant insects on the planet, the most colorful insects on the planet, and the largest insects on the planet. So it's very hard for a small child not to become fascinated and captivated with these things. Many of Australia's entomologists, it turns out, had the formative years in PNG, so I wasn't the only one who was corrupted by the fauna. We are already at this point. This morning I'm going to simply try and go through as many of the different insect orders as possible, differentiate for you how the orders are told apart from one another, and that will then be useful information for the field hike, which we have at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Anyone who wants to walk around in the sunshine with me and two butterfly nets, we're going to meet up on the arc around 2 o'clock, and then we'll just meander around wherever as long as you like, probably an hour and a half. Look at different things and talk about them. Anytime you want to ask questions, please ask questions. I don't mind whatever question. There's no dumb question in the world of entomology. And there's no general answer, because there's always going to be an insect which is going to prove the answer wrong. There are good generalizations, but then none of them are universal. My 1 minute of shameless commerce. If you really are interested in what's around the fauna here, pick up this field guide from the bookstore. It's absolutely superb, really easy to use. The information is great, it's well written. This is not entomology, but since so many of the insects you're going to be looking at are tied into the flora of the region, this book is incredible. Wildflowers of the Pacific Northwest. If you just want something to put in your back pocket or about the butterflies or moths, there's a little field guide you can stick in your back pocket. And then there's one with a lot of information about the butterflies. So the bookstore has all of these, and I can recommend all of them, and I don't get any commission. I'm just thrilled that someone wants to own an insect book. The sounds you were listening to when you came in is out of this book called The Songs of Insects. It's a wonderful thing. Has a CD which comes with it. And I picked up three of these, maybe four of these, whatever was left on the remainder of the remainder tables at Borders Books a couple months ago for $2 a copy, which is cheaper than a really bad cup of coffee from Starbucks. So, I have a couple of other books here, these are just mine. And if you want to try and find out what's chewing the pine trees in the valley, there's a whole host of insects. Many of them are not really a problem, but they're very well described in this book, which comes out of the Canadian Forest Service. You can go online and get it for free, order it, they send it to you. The wonders of having a Canadian government. This is a great little book on all the butterflies of the world, little handbook, great information, butterflies and moths. And then this is the wonders of having a US government, and it's a book on the moths and butterflies of the Pacific Northwest, extremely beautifully illustrated with the larvae and the moth, and bindings of little I've just pulled that page out. This particular moth apparently was up on the kiosk early this morning. Unfortunately, I didn't see it. Maybe it flew by our light trap on the way to the kiosk at 10 o'clock last night. But if I would have, I could have captured it and brought it in and showed it to you. There are beautiful things out there, isn't there? Yesterday we talked about the basic insect body shape and why they have been so really successful in colonizing the world. I introduced you to the concept or the reality or the fact, depending where you want to sit on that continuum, that insects actually rule the world. The number of insect species on this planet far exceeds the number of species of any other taxonomic classification, including plants. There's been over 1 million insects identified and classified. And that may simply be because of all the Victorian theologians who were bug collectors in their part-time. But it probably also reflects the fact that insects are just such a dominant, successful life form. They have an exoskeleton. And then all of the organs, heart, digestive system, nervous system, floats in the soup called hemocoel inside that exoskeleton. The brain is broken up in the insect body. You have the main brain, which is in the head. But then each of the segments has a sub-brain, a subganglion. So there's a lot of control which just happens at that particular level. The body shape has adapted into each of the different niches which that particular species occupies. So you have sucking mouthparts and you have chewing mouthparts. You have all kinds of different wing shapes. You have insects which are active at different times of day. It's not just, you know, one particular area, it's also they segment that behavior into different times of night. I like to use an example which I actually came to my mind from being at Holden Village many times, and that is that niche, occupying different niches, for a non-scientist, a great picture is just think of the different ways when you're at Holden that you figure out when you're going to take a shower. Because what you're simply doing is getting that niche which suits your needs, maybe not optimally if everybody wants to have a shower at 6:30 in the morning or 6:30 at night, but you're moving your behavior around so that you can find that empty niche to take your shower. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's the different kinds of plants I feed on, or the different kinds of rocks I sit under, or the different kinds of aphids I eat. All of that is simply specializing in a certain niche. Why is it important to understand entomology if you're not born an entomologist like I was? Insects are really key indicator species for many, many different things. They're used in areas as diverse as environmental health, where the number of larvae in the stream, which is flowing down the valley here, Railroad Creek, the number of larvae above the tailings and the diversity of larvae, the abundance of those larvae, how many different species, is far greater than in the areas where the stream is polluted by the tailings. They're easy to collect, they're easy to understand, there's so much known about them. And when you look at them in context of the ecology, they can really teach you a lot about the environmental effect of pollutants or climate change or many things like that. Insects are key in the world of forensic science, because many insects are recyclers. They do the decomposition process, whether it's plant or animal matter, so that the world isn't 40-foot high in permanent garbage or dead trees or what have you. And insect species are only found in certain areas. So forensic entomologists look at the cast skins of the larvae, the maggots, the flies, in corpses, whether that's humans or horses or whatever. And they can determine what time of year that decomposition happened. They can determine where the eggs were laid. So if you have a body moved from one place to a completely different place and it's got traces of insects from that first place, they can say very clearly this body was moved. Many different things like that. Some parts of the world, the maggots which feed on wounds are actually used in wound cleaning. So there's many areas. And then, of course, we had a little talk this morning about pollination. A quote which I like, which is not really widely known, 50% of our vitamin C intake is dependent on honeybee population. State of California's agriculture is about $6 billion of that is due to honeybee population. And when the pollination season happens in spring, it takes about 700,000 bee colonies, which are trucked in from all around the country. Okay, enough. That's just sort of background of things we talked about in the previous few sessions. So, insects are part of the animal kingdom, the opposite being the plant kingdom. The phylum is Arthropoda, the class Insecta, and then you have the orders. And what we're going to talk about today is basically the different orders, which is the sort of highest level classification system which separates a butterfly from a dragonfly from a true bug. And then once you get down below the order, you have families. So that's all the different subclassifications within that order, the different types of butterflies or the different types of true bugs. And then you go one step further. Apidae is bees. Apis mellifera is the European honeybee. Now, there's probably 800 to 1,500 native bees, which are all in this family, which have done the pollination of all the plants in North America before the European honeybee came along. And they're very successful, but they can't be farmed or turned into factory animals like I consider the honeybee. When we look at classifying insects, what's really sort of the starting point for a taxonomist is whether that insect has a complete or an incomplete transformation in the life cycle. And those are words which the scientists use. You may have a better word, partial or full, or I mean, three-step or four-step, but the science community talks about incomplete and complete, and there's Latin terms for incomplete is hemimetabolus, and complete is holometabolus. Insects go from egg to larva to adult. Now, with the ones which have a complete transformation, there's another step in here, which is the pupa. And so I'll get on to that next. Once you know that, then the number of wings and the shape of the wings, the function of those wings is really important. For example, wings define beetles. They have a hardened forewing and then a membranous hindwing. No other insect has that. Wings define flies. Flies only have two full complete wings rather than four, which the rest of the insect community have. Mouthparts define true bugs. All true bugs have sucking mouthparts. So that includes cicadas or bedbugs or other things like that. And then,
is that bugs as opposed to insects, or is that
just... No. Entomologists have this special order of insects, which we call bugs. When we're talking with all of you guys, we call them true bugs.
True bugs, okay.
But when you use the word bugs in an entomological community, they are immediately just thinking true bugs, which have a sucking mouth part, a sort of semi-hardened half wing. It does include cicadas, which are the true bugs get divided into the cicada leafhopper life forms and then the other true bug life forms.
Okay.
But so when I say true bugs, I'm just talking about that one group, which is Hemiptera Hemoptera. And then there's other specializations which are used in classification, you know, the leg shape. Grasshoppers, for example, all have that really strong kicking hind leg and other aspects of the insect's biology. When we get to the life form, the life cycle, I've said more or less the ones which keep their shape, so they don't go through this real transformation or shape change. The ones which keep their shape, the larva more or less looks like the adult, and it just gets bigger and bigger and develops wings in most of the species. These guys, the larva doesn't look even close to the adult. So think about the caterpillar and the moth, or the caterpillar and the butterfly. Or, on this side, the true bugs, where the little guy which hatches out of the egg basically has exactly the same shape as the adult. It doesn't have the wing buds. The wing buds grow every instar, and then you end up with the adult. Point of biology, because the insects have an exoskeleton, to go from one stage to the next, they have to break that skeleton open and crawl out, and then they're the next larger one, larger size. So, and that's called an instar. So this guy has to split his skin or cast his skin, and then he crawls out, he's this size, fills it out, gets enough nutrition, does the same thing again, and ends up going that way. More or less the same process with the holometabolous ones. Only with these, at this point here, basically the whole body contents liquefy and reorganize. So it goes from the system you had in the caterpillar, and it turns into the body that you have inside the beetle. Very different. Yes?
So the on the right there, you have the first, second, and third instar.
Yeah.
Those caterpillars actually shed their skin then?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So they okay.
Yeah. They all do. The skin is kind of soft.
Okay.
It's not hardened. These guys, with most beetles, they live in a cryptic environment. It means they're not out in the open. They're either boring in wood or they're feeding on the roots of plants. Mm-hmm. And so the environment offers them
some protection.
There's not as much threat of desiccation because the soil is moist or the cambium of the tree is moist. So they don't have that really hardened exoskeleton which the adult has. What this does is gives that insect the ability to colonize many different niches as one species. So the larvae feed on the roots of the plants, the adults may feed on nectar, or in a case of a monarch butterfly, it's taken it one step further where the larvae feed on the plants and then the adult can migrate phenomenal distances, 1,000 miles, because it's got that ability of flight. Some examples of the hemimetabolous. These are the ones which go through the incomplete stage. Lots of grasshoppers up here, katydids. You could put cockroaches up here, termites. And then dragonflies, damselflies. Dragonflies, the nymph looks a lot like the dragonfly, even though it may not seem that way to people who are just learning it. But it simply looks a lot like the dragonfly. It lives under the water. It lives on the rocks in the creek bed. It's a hunter the same way that the dragonfly is a hunter, but it grows the wings and then it flies.
Do they have a gill apparatus, or how do they get oxygen?
They do have a... Dragonflies have a... they get oxygen sort of through a gill, but damselflies have true gills down the side of the nymph, you know, hanging out. Dragonflies, it's more internal. But yeah, they do have that need to have a lot of body surface where the water exchanges with the body, where that diffusion, the gas exchange, the diffusion of the gas can take place. Holometabolous insects are your butterflies, beetles, some of the things like caddisflies, which are an aquatic insect, and of course wasps and so on. In here, you can see the heads of the wasp larvae. Bee larvae look pretty much the same. Although this is not bees, this is wasps. And then here you have a picture of what the adult looks like. Over here is a lady beetle, and this is an immature lady beetle. So you've probably seen these in your gardens if you're active gardeners. They're absolute aphid-eating monsters. But they then turn into the lady beetle. And that takes us to the next, or the first order of insects, which we'll talk about, the beetles. These were Darwin's favorite insect. Just as an aside, any of you know what Darwin started out as a young man? What his first career choice was?
Theologian.
Wrong.
Physician, wasn't
he? Yes. His first career choice was a physician. Then he went from physician to?
Theology.
And then he got invited to go on a world cruise. And the rest is history. He became probably the most prominent natural historian. But it's said that Darwin, there's a famous quote from Darwin, and it may be apocryphal, but it's attributed to him, that he said God must have had an inordinate fondness for beetles. And when beetles are the largest order of insects, the adults have a hardened wing, front wing, which gives them very good protection for the rest of the body. And the immature and the adults both have chewing mouth parts. And some are very serious pests. Others are very important recyclers. So they're in the decomposition process. Example of some beetles. If you do have the field guide, I don't think any of you have it with you, but they show up on page 24. That's what that little red box with the yellow print is. Just different kinds of body shapes. But they all have the hardened wing and chewing mouth parts. Sometimes the mouth parts are really adapted into, you know, what we call horns, which are used in very elaborate courtship and mating behavior and fights between males, where one male tosses the other male so that he gets the right to do the mating. This is a ground beetle similar to the one which was in the video yesterday. I blew it. Anyway, there we go. An inordinate fondness of beetles. I went ahead of myself. just a picture of some of the exquisite color which is in that animal family. These guys are actually called jewel beetles, Order Buprestidae. And they mostly spend their time in flowers as adults, and the larvae are wood borers in trees.
Where? Are everywhere. They around here?
Oh, yeah. But not those colorful ones. Those colorful ones are mostly tropical. But there are lots of buprestids in the forest here. Buprestids are one or two or three groups of insects which can detect heat. They have the ability to detect heat. And some of the forest buprestids, which are right at the forefront of recycling after forest fires, can detect embers from many miles. It's quite amazing. And then they fly upwind and they go to the tree when it's still got coals. Unfortunately, we live in here in the Pacific Northwest, in a part of the world where we do have fireflies, but the fireflies on the west coast of North America do not flash. So I'm sure many of you have seen fireflies in the east. They're exquisite. Fireflies have many different behaviors. Each one of these lines are a different species. They're flashing as they fly, different kinds of flashing pattern. This one's wiggling the abdomen in a continuous flash, or just, anyway. And different heights in the canopy where they do their flashing. So even in the behavior of looking for a mate, which is what the flashing is, it's the male firefly looking for the female firefly, there's this niche specialization in terms of canopy height, where I do my flashing. There are some species of fireflies which are synchronous, and it's absolutely amazing. You can be going down a creek in North Queensland or Costa Rica, and suddenly everything flashes on, and then it flashes off again. And there's a story, I don't have it with me, where in the early 1800s, synchronous flashing fireflies actually prevented the attack of Spaniards in Central America, because they thought that they were confronting an overwhelming enemy. Okay, moving on from beetles to butterflies, another order which has a complete life cycle. Immatures are called caterpillars or worms. The immatures have chewing mouth parts, like beetles, but the adults have a siphon. So it's that long, many of you know the term proboscis, which they use to suck up nectar or the juice from fruit, fermenting fruit, or sap on trees. The adults all have scaly wings, and some of them are massive agricultural pests. And they're also pests you see in your home, if you've got Indian meal moth, pantry moth, things like that. Clothes moth. Indian meal moth or pantry moth are simply recyclers. They're taking clothes moth, they're taking old plant material, old animal material, and they're recycling it. They just happen to be doing it in a part of the world that we call our home, so we don't like them. This is the largest moth. Well, the largest silk moth. There's another larger moth in Madagascar, but it's the largest silk moth, and that's what the adult looks like. And the caterpillar is that blue worm at the top. Difference between moths and butterflies is that when they're resting,
most moths, except these guys, of course, there's always exceptions, totally always exceptions. Most moths sort of fold the wing in this triangular shape over the top of the body, whereas the butterflies generally, if they're resting, have the wings open, or they rest with them vertically above the body. But it's not a good generalization. There are day flying moths, so for the most part moths are night flying. I don't know, you just when you've looked at enough of them you say, yeah, that's a moth, that's a butterfly.
Are there survival reasons for the wing position of rest?
I don't know. I don't know. You can see with this one here, which has been slightly disturbed, so it's sort of a little bit alert. When it's completely resting, this top wing, which is this, you can just see part of it here, actually slides down further, so that all you would see would be this mottled brown color to give it camouflage. The red color, when it's disturbed, is really a warning color to a predator. It's the same way that the insect has these eye patterns. Many of the butterflies and moths have these eye patterns, like here, to mimic the eye of a predator. Or there's been a very interesting study looking at swallowtails and some of the moths, where that shape on the wing actually looks like a caterpillar. So if you look at this, is the head of the caterpillar, and then you have the body segments going up that way. And so if someone wants to come and eat me and I think it's a caterpillar, the butterfly can lose a big chunk of this wing and it's not going to affect its ability to do its job at all. So instead of going for the body of the butterfly, it goes for the caterpillar on the wing. The bird is tricked. And there's many examples of this in different natural history collections where you've got a triangular bird peck out of the wing of a specimen in the collection and you know exactly what happened. The bird was fooled, the butterfly got away. Now the collector got it, but still. You can see the siphon mouth part here coming down from the head, which is an unrolled proboscis of that moth. I should have brought one of the hiking poles with me, but anyway, I can stretch. With the moths, the adults have the basic insect leg. The caterpillars have a number of these, they're called prolegs, which have a huge suction. I don't know if any of you have ever tried to pull a caterpillar off something that it's crawling on. It holds on phenomenally well because these legs basically have suction cups in them which hold them onto the plant that they're climbing on. Lepidoptera means scaly wings. So their wings have these overlapping scales and that's what gives the color. It's basically reflected light for the most part. Many very iridescent colors from these. This happens to be a male, and I know that because the antenna of that moth is very plumose or feather-like. The female antenna does not have those feathers, it's just very thread-like or like wire. The male antenna of a moth is charged with the job of fishing through the air to pick up the molecule of the sex pheromone of the female. So you want an organ which is broad and as much air can pass through that as possible. And same as the arm on a barnacle. Now barnacles are crabs which are basically stop being crab-like and they just live on a solid surface and then they filter the air, or coral again is a filter feeder. So that's what those adaptations are. Diptera, another order which is very successful, has two wings only, although they do have, you can see it best in this one up here, for example. See that little black short thing poking out under the front wing, which is hugely important in the balance of the insect. That's what the second wing has become, is just that little balancing organ. Diptera means two-winged. They go from egg to what we generally call maggot in the fly world, which is the same as larva or caterpillar. Several instars, then they have a pupa, and then they go to adult. The immatures have chewing mouth parts, and in the fly world, there's a great diversity of mouth parts in the adults. Piercing, sucking, sponging, cutting, no real chewing, but adapted in many ways. A housefly has a sponge kind of mouth part, and they actually moisten the surface they're feeding on with their own saliva, and then they soak it up again. That's how flies feed, which is why they're really good at transmitting disease from surface to surface. Mosquitoes have a piercing mouth part. That's how they do their feeding. Only one pair of wings, some very serious pests, especially in public health. The flies break up into two basic divisions. The ones which are like mosquitoes, sort of long legs, and a fairly slender body. They look fragile in many ways, these guys. And then there's the ones which are a lot more like houseflies, where the body is a very large part of the actual mass of the insect, and sort of stubby wings. And they are the most important insect order when it comes to transmission of disease. Insect vectors and human health, all of these, except for this guy here, are in the order of flies. This one happens to be a kissing bug, which is a true bug. And then you've got a mosquito, another mosquito, a sand fly, another mosquito, and these are probably black flies. Holden right now has both mosquitoes and black flies. Black flies are the tiny little guys, if you actually see them. You generally feel the black flies feeding. It's more painful because they have a cutting action when they feed, rather than the mosquitoes, which just pierce and go straight for that capillary.
Isn't that the same as called deer fly?
No. Deer flies are more like these guys. Deer flies are tabanids, but they have a cutting action as well. But they're larger.
Are deer flies and horse flies the same thing, or are they...
Deer flies and horse flies are both tabanids, and so they're in the same group, yes.
Size is different, though.
Yeah, horse flies are bigger.
You've had horses.
Yeah.
And then there's in some animal production, there are also bot flies associated with horses or cattle or deer, but those are totally different, and they're not really in the fly world. They're in a different order.
Are heel flies the same? Which is cattle?
I don't know what a heel fly is.
Heel fly is the adult form of cattle, which she lays her eggs on. You find cattle, and that seasonal would be in where it's playing in the water.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to avoid that because she lays her eggs and they feed it. Migrates from the larvae, actually comes out of the back.
Okay, that's a bot fly. Yeah. Easterly. Yeah. So, if you look at the most common vector-borne diseases, with malaria, it's about 2.1 billion people at risk in the world. 300 million cases a year and over 1 million deaths a year from malaria. Another statistic on malaria, 1 child in 5 in Africa probably dies from malaria before the age of 5. Schistosomiasis actually has to do with snails, so that's not in the insect world. Lymphatic filariasis is mosquito-borne, and dengue fever is mosquito-borne. The biggest vector-borne disease, the biggest health issue other than accidents and maybe some issues with dysentery and so on, the biggest health issue in Iraq and Afghanistan is a disease transmitted by sandflies called by the soldiers Baghdad Boil or the medical community Leishmaniasis. And there's 2 forms of Leishmaniasis, one which is visceral or on your skin, dermal or on your skin, and the other one which is visceral, where the wounds form on the inside of your body on your organs. And the really big problem with visceral Leishmaniasis is that you can't see that a person has been infected. So there's a strong effort in the medical community, the military medical community right now, to determine risk in different American communities as to whether the sandflies are present and could transmit leish from infected soldiers that had not been identified as being infected into the general population. There's a lot of work going on to make sure that that's addressed and taken care of.
How would they determine that a soldier is infecting it?
They're trying to look at picking up antibodies in the blood and things like that. But that means you've got to screen the whole force.
And what are the signs and symptoms of that?
General malaise. I mean, people get pretty sick. And the cure, unfortunately, although they're working on developing new drugs, the leish is part of something called a neglected tropical disease. And in the medical community, neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, have come to the forefront partly because of the Iraq War, but partly because of people like the Gates Foundation, who are saying these diseases affect so many in the world's population and so little is done about it because there's no profit. There's absolutely no profit motive or profit return. So Big Pharma has spent no time trying to come up with a leash or even really a dengue fever or something like that treatment. And that's where Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have stepped in and really directed huge amounts of money and effort and team building, sort of stakeholder community building to get those problems addressed. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is really remarkable. They're building a big tower in Seattle right now, and they have over 700 people in that non-profit running their programs. It's a big company. But Melinda Gates announced a year ago, maybe it was 2 years ago now, that in her lifetime she wants to see malaria eradicated from the planet.
Wow.
It's kind of a Kennedy-type statement, we will put people on the moon. And it has galvanized the community. There's many in the scientific community who say it's unachievable. And maybe it is, but just the fact that it's galvanized a lot of effort behind that initiative is really superb.
The moon was impossible. You did it.
The moon was an engineering rather than a biological question. Yeah. I've done a lot of work in the area of flies and disease. It's the main area I've been working on in the last 8 years. two big areas of research. One is I have developed a device for the automated identification of insects in flight, and we can identify what mosquito flies through the eaves of a hut in Kenya and figure out what time of day that was and report that. And it's important for trying to predict what's going to happen with a malaria outbreak. And then the thing which all of you should know, and very, very few people know, even in the entomological community, even less people pay attention to, is that the disease vectoring only happens when the female takes a blood meal. This is in the world of flies, different for kissing bugs. But so the female mosquito takes a blood meal maybe 3 or 4 times in her 2 to 4 week life cycle. When she takes that blood meal, the disease organism matures, and then when she goes to take another blood meal, the organism is injected into the next host, and that's how transmission occurs. Male mosquitoes, sandflies, deer flies, whatever, feed on sugars. And they probably sing in a very high voice. But they just feed on flowers. That's all they feed on. Or the sap from fruit or fermenting fruit or things like that. And females, most of their life cycle, only feed on those same sources of sugar. Because they need the energy in the sugar to fly. They only need the blood meal to get nitrogen to and other things, of course, but primarily nitrogen, to mature the eggs. So the whole medical entomology community has spent 50 years or 100 years trying to understand that moment of blood feeding and completely ignored the ecology of the male flies and basically completely ignored the ecology of the female when she's not taking a blood meal. And it's a huge area of research where if you could put out a lot of sugar baits and take the population level down on an area-wide basis to insignificant numbers, rather than just trying to prevent the female from biting the host, you might effect an area-wide control strategy. And that's my little soapbox of what I write research grants about. So. Now, in the South, they've developed another approach to mosquito management, which I think is really novel, and I'll put that up now. I'll try and quickly go through the rest. I know I'm using up lots of time. This is the dragonflies and the damselflies. These are aerial predators. They are hemimetabolous, meaning they don't have a pupal stage. Ecologically split. The larvae are aquatic and the adults are aerial. Dragonflies are sort of like the Spitfire bombers of the insect world. They're amazing, absolutely amazing. And they have those huge eyes. And the huge eyes are needed so that they can see things flying, and they have a basket-shaped leg. It's sort of like a basket, their legs. And that enables them to swoop in and catch a mosquito in flight or whatever else they're eating. They have chewing mouth parts, and then they land and catch. Damselflies aren't quite the swooping predators that dragonflies are. Their flight's a lot more dainty, but they're also predaceous. And there's a number of tropical damselflies which actually hover at spider webs and pluck the spider off the web, and that's what they feed on. And if you have a chance to see video of that in some of the nature shows, it's just stunning, really stunning. Very big eyes. The eye forms most of the head of that insect, which informs you how much, you know, energy is, or how much energy is used by that particular animal in vision. Other thing about dragonflies is that when they mate, the female stays attached to the male while she's laying her eggs. And you've probably seen these guys flying around if you've spent any time around streams. Bees, wasps, and sawflies. That's wrong, actually. The holometabolus. Phil, you messed up on that one. So they have a pupal stage. Four wings as opposed to two wings in the flies. And very important, probably the world's most important insect is the honeybee, just because of the downstream economic value of pollination. And there are many wasps which are critical biological control agents because they lay their eggs in caterpillars and things like that and parasitize them and control the pests that way. Ants are kind of a nuisance for most of us, but they are phenomenal predators as well, and they're also important recyclers. And they're also important, some of the seed-feeding ants, in moving plant species around. So that's the way the seeds get moved around. An example of the different shapes, a wasp up at the top, ants. There is the one form of an adult ant, the mating form, where they have wings, but most of the ant colony does not, and then of course bees. And grasshoppers, again, they don't have a pupal stage. They all got chewing mouth parts. Two pairs of wings, but the forewing is really hardened, forms a protection over the body in most of them. And crickets, katydids. That's what you were listening to if you came in early before the talk started, grasshoppers. This is the way they make their sound. They have these structures on the body, which is like a file. And then they rub another part of the body over that structure. And so it's essentially a washboard. But they're very small, and the rubbing is probably like this. And that's what the sound comes from. Sound is primarily a signal for mating, but the males do get into sort of sound duels from time to time in some of the species. Form huge populations. This is a locust swarm. And going back to biblical times, it's been an issue in many parts of the world. There's the Australian Locust Commission to manage the problem in Australia. Locusts are a major issue right now in the Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, the countries, the Stans in Central Asia. And the US is putting quite a lot of effort in trying to help manage that situation. They've been fingered a number of years ago. There was a huge grasshopper plague in Kansas, and it didn't happen in Missouri so much. And always people have, you know, tried to explain things in religious terms. The Kansas plague of grasshoppers was attributed by the leaders of religious thought at that time to the anger of the Christian deity who sent it as a punishment for the sins of the people. But what is even cooler, and I don't know where you all are from, but it is certain, and remarks were made at that time, that the people of western Missouri did not suffer any serious effects from the plague, like the people of Kansas. Yet no Kansan at that time would have admitted that Missourians were spiritually better than Kansans.
There you have it.
In most of the world, that's why I put God's special insect up there. In most of the world, grasshoppers are a really important part of the local diet. A huge source of protein and fat, and critical in communities where you don't have meat at certain times of year.
They eat the whole thing?
Eat the whole thing.
Just like that. Just like,
that. And these are probably, these are out of Mexico. I've got pictures of different kinds of insects as food, which will be in my talk at 6 o'clock tomorrow night. Have your lunch, have your dinner beforehand, if you're squeamish. But if you're have curiosity in the whole thing, I will ask you tomorrow how many of you eat shrimp or lobster or crawdads. And I will explain to you that they simply are aquatic insect life forms. So, last ones, the true bugs. These guys have that incomplete life cycle. The front wing is half leathery and hardened and half membranous. So this part is hard and this other part is sort of membranous, and that defines those groups. And they have sucking mouth parts. And there's only one true bug which has become a disease vector, but it sucks blood. Several of them are aquatic. Some taxonomists, I learned them all as being Hemiptera. Nowadays they tend to split them up into two orders, between the ones which are more like leafhoppers or cicadas, and they call them Homoptera. But they... So here's an example of these guys. Some can be extremely colorful, and they tend to be plant feeders, and they're a big issue in things like tomatoes or citrus. They're also really, really good predators, because with that sharp, piercing beak, this happens to be one feeding on an ant. It's basically sucking the blood out of the ant. And then there's this one species which have gone bad called kissing bugs, and a major problem in South and Central America. I've done a lot of work on kissing bugs and then moved that work onto bed bugs as well. And we've developed the world's first precise little detection device for bed bugs. You've probably heard about bed bugs in the press. They're one of the more common insects to be talked about right now. It is a real problem. It's not just a kind of big story that the press can carry. Interesting animal. I think that bed bugs are actually the definitive proof of intelligent design. They are so exquisitely adapted to being a pest of humans. I mean, they will not walk on glue. They will stay off insecticide-treated surfaces. Their feeding behavior is just perfectly matched with human beings. So if anybody wants to talk to me about intelligent design, I can give them proof that only someone as brilliant as a creator could have made a bed bug so perfect. Anyway, thank you all. I'm sorry I went on maybe a bit longer than I should. Thank you.